And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Ways. I'll be your host for today's program. Following National Native News, we'll get an update on Eagle Crest activities with Jeff Reclow. Stephanie Hogue and John Straub will offer a preview of their presentation called Cycling Europe's Rivers Route. And we're going to learn about the silver set from the USS Juno. Mark Wilcox will be here to highlight this year's Backcountry Film Festival. All that, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more, up next on a Juno Afternoon on KTOO Juno, repeated at 4 on KRNN, and available on demand at ktoo.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe is researching the requirements for repatriating remains of tribal members who died while attending the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Jim Kent spoke with the tribe's historic preservation officer about the process and what hurdles he's encountering.
The Rosebud Sioux Tribe has been gathering information about how to repatriate the remains of at least 10 Lakota students who died at Carlisle in the 19th century. Knowing the students' remains are there is one thing, says Tribal Historic Preservation Officer Russell Eagle Bear. Getting approval to repatriate them may be quite another.
They wanted proof of relationship, proof of consent and authority on behalf of the family, and an affidavit or court order showing all of the family is representing consent to the proposed course of action. Consent of the tribe or Indian nation involved.
A waiver of any liability against the federal government, and the list goes on. In the end, notes Eagle Bear, the decision on whether or not to permit the repatriation rests with the commanding officer of what is now the U.S. Army War College at Carlisle. That's because the site is an active military base. Eagle Bear has also learned that the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, which protects Native remains and funerary objects, doesn't apply to active military bases. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe has petitioned the South Dakota congressional team for assistance with the repatriation and also plans to ask President Obama to intercede. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has released a preliminary report about the fate of metals contained in the waste spilled last year from the Gold King mine. The agency says most metals came to rest in the bed of the Animas River. Waste reached the Navajo Nation, where the spill's effects are still being determined. Ryan Heinches has more.
The EPA estimates more than 880,000 pounds of metals spilled from the mine. The report says the waste was diluted as it flowed downstream, but some of the metals flowed into the San Juan River and through the Navajo Nation in New Mexico. The report didn't confirm which metals were in the waste, but researchers believe it likely contained cadmium, copper, lead, and mercury, among others. In August, workers with the EPA accidentally triggered the spill of more than 3 million gallons from an inactive mine near Silverton, Colorado. By the time it flowed into the San Juan River, many farmers on the Navajo Nation had stopped irrigating their crops. Some went weeks without water, and tribal officials are still assessing the spill's effects to those communities. Navajo President Russell Begay has said he's considering legal action against the EPA. Officials with the agency say pollution in the Animas and San Juan Rivers returned to pre-spill levels shortly after the incident. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
New Mexico Congressman Steve Pierce recently introduced the Gold King Mine Spill Accountability Act. Pierce says the bill ensures that those responsible for the spill are held accountable by commissioning a special investigation. It allows the state, instead of the Environmental Protection Agency, to carry out a long-term water quality monitoring plan, which Pierce says prevents a conflict of interest. The EPA was responsible for the spill, yet Pierce says no one answered for the damage this bill caused. The bill also helps to expedite claims for parties injured as a result of the spill. President Obama's 2017 budget proposal includes $13.4 billion for the Interior Department, which includes Indian Country. According to the White House, the budget provides increases across a wide range of federal programs which serve tribes, such as education, social services, health, infrastructure, land, water, and other natural resources. The budget for the Bureau of Indian Affairs is $2.9 billion, a $138 million or 5% increase over 2016. The budget, released Tuesday, is already facing a fight in Congress. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who had their day one at nativenews.net. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Support comes from the Copper Whale Inn, located in downtown Anchorage, near business and arts, activities and events, with breakfast served daily. The Copper Whale Inn. Reservations online at copperwhale.com.
I'd like to welcome into the studio Jeffra Clow, who's a regular along with other folks on staff up at Eagle Crest during the winter season. Of course, we'd like to stay in touch with what's going on up on the mountain. So let's just start with the general update. You know, Saturday, I was out and about in the valley, and it was actually snowing, and I thought, oh, this is a good sign. I'm at sea level, and there's actually snow. So how is it up on the mountain?
You know, it's good up on the mountain. It's definitely very much winter at the top of the mountain. Down at the base, Mother Nature hasn't been as kind to us as we would like. We still have plenty of snow in the Porcupine chair. We still have plenty of snow at the bottom of the mountain. It is thin, so we're urging our skiers and snowboarders to just use caution at the bottom part of the mountain. We did get a little bit of rain. Luckily, we just have warm temperatures this week and not a lot of rain this week. So we're hoping that the forecast calls for a little cooler temperatures and we get some more snow, but just want to go out there. That I skied all afternoon on Monday afternoon. It was fabulous. So there's no shortage up top.
Yeah, well, and that's what I've heard from people. They've said, you know, winter's here. You just have to be willing to go up on the mountain. And fair enough. That's where the ski resort is, too. So if, for those of you who are jonesing for some snow and some winter sport, it's there. You just have to get up to 1,000 feet or higher, right?
Yeah, you do. And, you know, one of the things that we look at, we keep tabs a little bit on the Porcupine learning area, is it's still good skiing and snowboarding there. So if this is your season, you decided you wanted to learn how to ski or learn how to snowboard or have taken a lesson with us earlier in the season, don't give up. Come up. Take a lesson, get those ski and snowboard legs underneath you, because we still have a long winter to go. So we're not done yet. So don't let this warm weather worry you.
Winter is coming.
Winter has always been here. It's just been a little fickle, but we're okay, and we're having a great time up on the mountain.
Yeah. So I always ask you about the Nordic conditions. So maybe let's just do how are the Nordic conditions, and then you can talk about the special guest you have coming into town.
Sure. Well, Nordic conditions are just kind of like the rest of the mountain. Our lower Nordic loops, trails are unfortunately don't have a lot of snow on them. So for our beginning Nordic skiers, that's been a little frustrating for us. We haven't had much to offer them. But for our intermediate and advanced Nordic skiers, we've had some great condition on the upper mountain, on our upper loop. So you do have to hike up to our upper loop, but once you get up there.
Good exercise.
Good exercise. It's beautiful up there. It's definitely, like you said, it's bona fide winter up there.
Yeah.
And so we've been doing a fair number of classes, private lessons, and group lessons for both intermediate and advanced skate and classic skiers all season. So.
And now you have a special guest coming into town, I think on Friday, is that what you said, or Thursday? Or?
We do. Coming into town for this coming weekend is, his name is Scott McGee, and every year we always bring in training opportunities for our instructors in both alpine, snowboard, and Nordic realms. So this year we reached out to Scott McGee, who is on the Professional Ski Instructors of America, the national team. He's been on that national team for over 16 years now and has been the coach of it for 8 years. So the national team is the group of instructors that go out and coach the instructors throughout the whole country. So we reached out to Scott because we hadn't had him up here. He's from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and said, Scott, would you like to come to Juneau? And Scott jumped at the chance, so we're really excited. So we're offering a training session for our instructors on Monday. But we decided, hey, Scott's got some valuable hints and lots of information that he can give to the public as well. So on Saturday and Sunday, we've opened it up and we're doing workshops for intermediate and advanced skiers, Nordic skiers.
So classic and skate skiing?
Classic and skate skiing. So Saturday morning is classic skiing, Saturday afternoon is skate, and then Sunday morning is skate as well. And the cost is $44 plus tax. You do need to make a reservation in advance, and you can call 790-2000 extension 211. If you call right now, you'll have to leave a message because we're closed, but we'll get you tomorrow morning. But this is a great opportunity, and we've talked to a lot of folks around the community. Our Nordic instructors are very excited to get a chance to ski with Scott. And the one thing I keep hearing over and over again is, oh, you know what, this sounds great, but I'm going to wait and see what the weather looks like. And I just want to encourage you, hey, the weather's going to be what the weather's going to be, but Scott's going to be here. And Scott will, as a professional, he will make the most of it, whatever the weather is. And so I encourage you to sign up because space is limited. And so don't play the weather game. We know. We live in Juneau. We just do it, regardless of what the weather is. So I encourage everyone to get out there and take advantage of this opportunity.
Yeah, and the snow is there for the skiing, so that's not the question.
Yeah, the snow is there for the skiing, and Scott has some great experience that he is willing to share with our community. And so we're very excited to have Scott in town, and so we hope people will sign up and share his knowledge as well.
So anything extra special planned for Scott while he's not teaching people how to ski?
We're just going to let him get to know Juneau, let him get to know the Eelcrest community.
Yeah.
So it'll be we're going to keep him busy the whole time that he's here. So he's doing the workshops for the public. He's doing a workshop on Sunday afternoon for the Juneau Nordic team. So that'll be all the youth.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to get an opportunity to ski with him as well. And then on Monday, he'll be doing a workshop for all of our instructors up at the mountains. So that's going to be a great opportunity. So we'll keep him pretty busy and get him a chance to experience a little bit of Juneau in between.
Anything else you wanted to mention today regarding Eelcrest this week?
Well, you know, it is a busy weekend. We have a 3-day weekend this coming weekend with President's Holiday on Monday.
Thanks for reminding me.
So I just wanted to make note that the snow bus will be operating Saturday, Sunday, and Monday.
Yeah.
So that's always helpful to know. On Monday, we have season pass holders clinics. So if you're a season pass holder, you can take a free clinic that'll work on your skills on different topics on the mountain. You do need to make a reservation for these at least 48 hours in advance so we can make sure we have the adequate staffing. And this week's topic is exploring the ridge. So I urge if you're a season pass holder to take advantage of that. And then we have another adult workshop that's our 4-week Ptarmigan and Beyond series that starts on Sunday. So that's for alpine skiers and alpine skiers or snowboarders who want to kind of work on their skills a little bit more on the upper mountain, exploring the ridge, exploring different kinds of terrain. And that's called Ptarmigan Beyond. And you can find that information on skijuneau.com or call us at 790-2000 extension 211.
As always, lots being offered up on the mountain by the staff and the crew at Eelcrest. So thank you for providing that service to the community. And Jeffrey Klaus, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me in. And just remember, winter's not over. Don't give up on it yet.
I agree.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 10th of February, 2016. It's the birthday of the playwright and poet Bertolt Brecht, born in Augsburg, Germany, 1898. Bertolt Brecht, a Marxist who regarded his plays as social experiments, did not want the audience to become emotionally involved with the story, rather to acknowledge the stage as a stage and the actors as actors and not as real people. With Hitler's rise to power in 1933, Brecht left Germany, moved to Denmark, then Sweden, Finland, journeyed across Russia, settled in Hollywood in 1941, as in Germany his books were burned and his citizenship was withdrawn. It's the birthday of Boris Pasternak, born in Moscow, 1890. Did not write for many years in the 30s and early 40s because of his fear of censorship under the government of Joseph Stalin. and then around 1945 began to work in secret on his masterpiece, Dr. Zhivago. Finished it in 1955, smuggled it out of the Soviet Union. It was published in Italy, became an international bestseller, an epic novel about more than 60 characters through the first half of 20th century Russia. And it's the birthday of the Norwegian journalist Astny Sejersted, born in Oslo, 1970, best known for The Bookseller of Kabul, which came out in 2003, was a big bestseller. Astny Sejersted, who after college in Norway went to China to study Chinese, to Berlin to learn German, Moscow to work for a news agency, Belgrade to live in an artist's colony, also lived in Mexico, France, Italy. She became fluent in five languages and okay, as she puts it, in four more. And after 9/11, she spent weeks in rural parts of Afghanistan with the commandos of the Northern Alliance, traveling in military vehicles, sleeping on stone floors and in mud huts. She rode into Kabul with the Northern Alliance in November 2001 and found a bookstore, a place owned by an elegant, gray-haired Afghan man, well-educated, who loved to talk about politics and writing. The man was passionate about books. He'd hid them from the Taliban. He'd gone to prison. He invited her to a meal with his family, and she decided to write a book about them. She lived with them for 3 months, and the book she wrote, The Bookseller of Kabul, was a huge success, except with the bookseller himself, who was not happy about the way he'd been portrayed, and he flew to Norway to denounce her, and wrote his own book, called Once Upon a Time, There Was a Bookseller in Kabul, about how a Norwegian troll visits Afghanistan and abuses his family's hospitality. Here's a poem for today by William Blake, Nurse's Song. When the voices of children are heard on the green and laughing is heard on the hill, my heart is at rest within my breast, and everything else is still. Then come home, my children, the sun has gone down, and the dews of night arise. Come, come, leave off play, and let us away till the morning appears in the skies. No, no, let us play, for it is yet day, and we cannot go to sleep. Besides, in the sky the little birds fly, and the hills are all covered with sheep. Well, well, go and play till the light fades away, and then go home to bed. The little ones leaped and shouted and laughed, and all the hills echoed. William Blake, Nurse's Song. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine. Now available on iOS devices. Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games, Lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio Stephanie Hogue. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Now, your partner, John Staub, is not here.
He's not here. He's shy on the radio.
Shy on the radio. So the two of you have an adventure, a bike adventure to talk about, and it's being you're part of the bike adventure series, which Cycle Alaska is putting on. The title is Cycling Europe's Rivers Route. And this presentation will be this Thursday, February 11th at 5:15 p.m. at Cycle Alaska, correct?
That's right. That's tomorrow.
So, we'll circle back and we'll talk about the series a little bit and the details. But Cycling Europe's Rivers Route. So I read a little bit about it, and this is a wonderful, it sounds to me like a wonderful long journey on a bike ride across Europe. And you're going to present slides and tell people all about it on Thursday, but right now you get to tell the radio audience about it. So how did you come upon this? What made you decide to go do this?
Well, we had not been bicycling in Europe for quite a while, and we had been thinking about that. And as I was just telling you, our previous bike trip to this one had been down from Eugene, Oregon, to San Francisco, and we managed to go the inland route and maybe climb one or two 6,000-foot hills every day. So we said, maybe we should pick somewhere flat. And we started out looking at the Danube cycleway that goes along the Danube River. And then we discovered this amazing thing. And I think everyone who has ever wanted to bike should know about this Eurovelo route system. It's over the last 20 years, the European Cyclist Federation has gotten together, and they've developed 14 different long-distance international cycling routes across Europe. And they are in various stages of completion, but they should all be done by 2020, which isn't too far off. And it will be 40 or 50,000 miles of cycle routes across Europe.
Wow.
And they're very well supported by people who like having bicyclists come through, and lots of businesses that cater to bicyclists, and they're signposted. So you just follow the signs and keep on going. A lot of the route is on nice cycle paths that are totally away from traffic.
So you started where?
Okay, so back to that. We started in Nantes on the west coast of France, and the route we did was called Eurovelo 6. And so we went up the Loire River and all the way across France. In the eastern part of France, we followed a couple other rivers, the Saône and the Doubs, and we went along a lot of canals. Then we joined up with the Rhine River and spent a few days along that before we crossed over to the very headwaters of the Danube. And we followed the Danube all the way to Budapest. The route goes on past there, but that's where we stopped.
So how many miles?
We managed to rack up 1,750 miles in the course of the trip.
And how long was the trip?
It took us 6 weeks.
And was that for you guys a leisurely pace, or were you pushing it?
It was a pretty leisurely pace. We actually took a lot of rest days when we got to the big cities, because we went through Passau, and we went through Basel before Passau. We went through Vienna and Bratislava, and so we wanted to explore those cities. And
so multiple countries here. Which country? You start in France, and then you...
Okay, we started in France, and then we were in Switzerland for a couple of days. Then we went through Germany, Austria, a little bit of Slovakia, and Hungary.
And you're basically kind of following major rivers or connecting with kind of river systems as you go.
Yes. So it's called the rivers route because it does follow a lot of the big rivers, and that makes it delightfully flat, although not perfectly flat.
And very scenic, I imagine?
Very scenic. We saw a castle on every hill sometimes. We saw a lot of beautiful little villages. Some magnificent big cities. We went through farmland. We went through some really nice wine growing regions. And
are you camping all the way? Are you doing B&Bs? Are you doing just a combination? I'm assuming you've got everything you need with you all the time, so you have the option to do whatever works best that day in terms of lodging at the end of the day. And
yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And we do love to go self-contained, and we love to go on unscheduled trips. And so we did carry our camping gear, minimal camping gear, not like you would need to go in the wilds of the Yukon or anything, but, you know, just a tent and some bags. And I think we camped about a third of the time while we were on the road.
Mm-hmm.
We enjoyed the camping, but there were lots of reasonable hotels. Because we did it in May and June, we were skipping the really busy season, which would be July and August. And so we were able to just show up and find places to stay all along the route.
And it sounds like the route probably mostly was pretty quiet, pretty peaceful, that you're not on the big thoroughfares. I mean, I realize you end up in cities at times, but for the most part, sounds like a real bike-friendly route.
Yes, it is. For the most part, you're very much away from traffic, except, of course, in the cities. And there was a little section in the western part of Hungary that wasn't quite finished yet, where we had to go along one busy road for a little while, but that was it.
So for people tomorrow night at 5:15 at Cycle Alaska that come to see your presentation, just give it real briefly. What are they going to see? What are you going to talk about? Are you going to slides? Are you going to talk about the logistics of what you brought with you? Those kinds of things, or
yes, exactly. We took way too many pictures, so I've got that narrowed down to not that many. And we will we'll show a little bit about what we did and where we went, and we'll go through a real quick little travelogue where we'll show what we thought were the highlights of the different countries and. We'll show a few of the people we met, and then at the end we'll talk about the logistics. And there's so many different ways people could do trips along this route for parts of it or all of it. There's bike and barge tours, and there's guided tours, and there's people who camp every single night.
Mm-hmm. So will you share with people who come to the presentation some of your favorite moments or moments that went terribly wrong or, those kinds of things?
Yeah, I think we will. And surprisingly, we didn't really have too many moments that went wrong on that trip.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Anything really surprise you on the trip? I mean, I think, we always try to say we don't have expectations, but we always do have expectations. Did anything really surprise you that you didn't see? That you didn't think you would experience on the trip?
Oh, not that I can think of offhand, although every day there were new things and surprising things to see. Probably what surprised me the most was how nice the route was, because we had anticipated that we might hop on trains now and then to make up time or mm-hmm. just not really bike the whole route, but once we got on it, we liked the route so much we didn't want to miss any of it.
And I'm assuming the people were friendly and the food was good and et cetera.
The people were friendly, the food was good. The languages were a little bit of a challenge because we were in so many countries that spoke other languages that we're not able to learn them all. I tried to learn some French, and that helped me get by in France.
And then suddenly you were in another country.
And,
so.
Yes, and suddenly we were in Switzerland, Germany, and Austria, and I was saying, why didn't I learn some German? But people were friendly, and people usually knew enough English that we didn't have any trouble getting what we needed.
Yeah, sounds great. And you've done these kind of trips before, it seems to me. This isn't your first long-distance bike adventure, correct?
That's true, although this was the first one where we've ever followed somebody else's route. And we liked that. That made it pretty easy. And they'd gone to a lot of work to set this route out in a way that you would see nice things mm-hmm. and you would stay away from traffic.
Anything else you want to add about tomorrow evening's presentation?
Nothing I can think of. There'll be time for questions.
Will John be with you?
John will be with me, and
okay.
He will.
He'll be talking
tomorrow.
He'll
be talking, although he will be leaving maybe before we're done because he's rehearsing for the opera.
Well, that's a good excuse.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Stephanie Hoag on a Juneau Afternoon talking about the bike adventure series at Cycle Alaska. It's titled, tomorrow's presentation is titled Cycling Europe's Rivers Route, and that will be at 5:15 p.m. at Cycle Alaska. Stephanie, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Jamie.
Got them deep river blues. Let that rain drive right on. Let those waves sweep along. I have got them deep river blues. good old pal, but she walks like a waterfowl when I get them deep river blues. There ain't no one to cry for me. All the fish go on a spree when I get them deep river blues. Got them deep river blues. I'm a going back to Muscle Shoals. The fishing's better there, I'm told, because I got them deep river blues. River blues. And now I'm going to say goodbye, and if I sink, just to let me die, I've got them deep river blues. Let it rain, let it pour, let it rain a whole lot more. I've got them deep river blues. Let that rain dry right on, let those waves just sweep along. I've got them deep river blues.
And we were just listening to the group by the name of Barefoot, I believe. I think I got that right. So I'd like to welcome into the studio three members of the Mendenhall Flying Lions. I think I got that correct. And they're here to talk about a really interesting story. And unfortunately, we don't have maybe enough time, but we'll get to as much of it as we can. It's about the silver set that's coming back to Juneau on loan for all of us to see and think about the history related to it. And it's the silver set of the USS Juneau, the original USS Juneau. And these folks, the Mendenhall Flying Lions, are the sponsor group, I believe, the organization that's making this possible. So we're going to start with Mike Norton, who I believe is the president, and
yes.
Talk a little bit about the organization and maybe about how this got started.
Yep, exactly. In 2017, Lions International will be celebrating their centennial. The Lions International was started in Chicago when a businessman went to a business conference and told the business people that they needed to do things for their community and not just make money. So that's where it started. And Lions Club International has asked all the clubs all throughout the world to do a legacy project, and they want that project to be a visible gift to our community. Mm-hmm. And this USS Juneau presentation silver will be one of our club's legacy projects.
Great. Is this the first legacy project? Or,
yes. Yeah. We haven't got any others yet, but we're working on it.
Yeah, well, one at a time, and this is a really good one. So start with you, Donna. Donna Hurley is also in the studio, and Tom Dawson is in the
Correct.
Studio from the club. So do you want to start the story? Or,
certainly.
Yeah, we'll start with Donna.
Back in 1938, President Roosevelt decided to name one of the new cruisers coming out, the USS Juneau. And she was assigned the ship numbers CL-52. It is naval history to present silver. It shows your pride in the ship that's named for you, also patriotism. And here we are. It's 1941. We're in a war. Economy's down. The money was raised by the citizens of Juneau. Nickels and dimes and pennies. They sold silver certificates. They raised $1,000. The mayor and his wife took the silver back, presented it to the CL-52. From there, we go into the history of the ship, but I'll kind of round it out.
And the silver is what?
The silver consists of a punch bowl, a tray, a ladle, 24 cups, and two of the four candlesticks originally presented. And it has served aboard three ships, the 5-2, the 119, and most recently the LPD-10.
So it's a tradition to do this when a ship is being commissioned, is that correct, a silver mm-hmm. set? So it's on the USS Juno, and then what happens?
Well, the USS Juno went to war and fought in the Battle of Guadalcanal. The silver set is removed. All unnecessary items are taken off of battleships before they go into battle. So that's why this silver set is still available and didn't go down with the ship. Hmm. And in the Battle of Guadalcanal in the South Pacific, in the Solomon Islands, just northeast, about 1,000 miles northeast of Australia, is where this battle took place. And during this battle, the USS Juno was twice struck by torpedoes. And after the first torpedo struck, it was about 18 folks, sailors on board that were killed. And she stayed in the battle for a while and was slowly going down on her bow, but she could still make way. So she was headed out of battle to go get some repairs when the second torpedo struck. And this one hit her magazine. And the ship was totally destroyed and went down within minutes, within seconds, within less than a minute. And when the second torpedo struck, over 550 of the men were killed instantly, and about 100-150 were blown into the water. And it was such a terrific explosion, they didn't feel that anyone survived it, so rescue efforts weren't started at that time. And 8 days later, when they did start doing the rescue, of those 150, there were only 10 survivors.
So the silver set, meantime, is in storage somewhere.
On the East Coast, correct. Mm-hmm. But in 1946, the 119 was christened. So
this is the USS Juno. It's the next boat.
Second ship.
Right?
Second ship.
Okay.
And she gladly, of course, accepted the silver. The first Juno was 9 months old when she was sunk.
So the second ship has the silver. Mm-hmm. And then what happens?
She served in Korea.
Yeah, she served in the Korean War in 1950 to 1952. And she was later taken out of service. And in 1955, she was decommissioned. And then in 1962, she was scrapped.
And so the silver set goes where?
Goes back to the U.S. Navy. And they held on to it again mm-hmm. until the third ship. And it was transferred to the LPD-10, which is code for the Navy code of an LPD-10, is an amphibious transport dock. And she was a little bit larger than the original two ships. And so the silver was back on board her ship under the command of Captain Eugene Bailey.
Okay. And then the timeline moves along here?
Timeline moves along rapidly. In 1985, a man by the name of Steve Van Dragon came to a group of citizens that at that time was doing the 4th of July parade and said, "Hey, this is a good research project. Why don't we build a memorial?" So we did. Again, all donated funds from the city of Juneau. And as he was sailing from San Diego to Juneau aboard the LPD-10 with Captain Bailey, Captain Bailey took him into the safe, and lo and behold, the silver service from the CL-52 was there. It was able to be used here in Juneau for the first time to honor 5 of the 10 survivors. Mm-hmm. After that, it went back on board and was lost.
Lost?
Mm-hmm. Don't know where it went. Don't know if it was in storage or stayed on board. The LPD-10 was decommissioned in 2008. I sent a nice little email to Senator Murkowski, asked if her staff could try and locate it. Heard from the Rear Admiral, who is her liaison officer. "Yes, ma'am, we know where it is. It's in San Diego." Jane and Jody up at the Juno Douglas City Museum, got all of the paperwork started. They went through 13 months of contracts back and forth to get what the Navy calls a permanent loan. In other words, unless it's needed or requested elsewhere, it will remain here in their care for 10 years.
So it's coming here.
It is here.
It's here. So there's a reception. There's going to be an unveiling. So we've
that
got this
will be on February 14th, which is the 74th anniversary of her christening.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when they'll open the doors at the museum and invite everyone in to see the silver that's been missing since 1942 from its home port. So we're pretty proud of it.
Yeah, and the permanent loan thing is wonderful. I mean, that's very appropriate. So for the reception for the event, are you folks presenting? Will there be a presentation? Is there going to be a historical display that goes along with this? What will people be seeing or hearing?
Right now, we are just going to put the silver on display. Mm-hmm. They have many other artifacts that have come from families of the crew members. Those may go on display next year on the 75th. I don't know what Jody's planning, but she has put together a marvelous, marvelous book. We have gone back and researched old newspaper articles from 1938 forward, mm-hmm. and she has letters from loved ones and just, it's a complete history in yeah. that file folder, but everybody's just going to come through, be able to see the silver. You'll see the lions there. We'll have our gold vests on. Just ask us any questions you want, but this is all about the silver.
And the history of Juno, and we've got generations of families.
Correct.
That connect back to the fundraising, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming there's people who remember this, or it's been passed down to them, the story.
Randy Wanamaker, who's on the board of directors at Gold Belt,
mm-hmm.
his sister was working in the shipyards in Seattle, sent money home to donate to the silver. Randy, during his younger days, he actually worked in a shipyard and helped build the LPD-10. So, yeah, we go back quite a way.
Well, you folks must be really excited about this. I mean, you the legacy, you know, yep. challenge project, and you picked an idea and you've pulled it off. You've done it. This thing's going to be residing here in Juno. And
Donna Hurley is... she's been like a dog with a bone. She took this on, and the rest of us got...
That's a compliment, John.
Yes, it is. She's worked really hard on this, and the rest of the folks that have worked on this have done a great job.
Yeah.
And one of the things she left out was when she got all the contracts done, one of our Lions Club members actually went down to San Diego, hand-packed the silver, and hand-carried it back to Juno.
Quite an honor there.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a lot of fun.
So we've been speaking with this is Donna Hurley, Mike Norton, Tom Dawson, all with the Mendenhall Flying Lions. They're the organization that has had the vision to try to you know, get the silver set and have it perhaps come to Juno and be on loan, and that's exactly what's happening. This is the original silver set from the original USS Juno. So the unveiling, the reception is Sunday, February 14th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Juno.
No? 12 noon.
12 noon.
Noon
sorry.
To 4.
Noon to 4. Okay, noon to 4. So Sunday the 14th, noon to 4 at the City Museum. And before we wrap it up, anything else that you wanted to add today before we... Included.
Tomorrow evening from 5 to 7, we're doing a Veterans Appreciation at the buoy deck.
Mm-hmm.
And Captain Bailey will be there. The Lions will be there. And we just want to thank all of our veterans. They have been involved in every project that we have done. So 5 to 7 at the buoy deck.
The good old buoy deck. Tom, anything to add?
Nope. I think we've covered it all. And just want to thank Donna for keeping us all going on this project.
And Mike, anything else to add?
Well, if people want to follow what the Mendenhall Flying Lions are doing, we have a blog, and it's called The Flying Lions of Juno, all one word, .blogspot. And there's you can see what we're doing here in town, and more projects to come.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, congratulations to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. One of the most difficult skills to pick up when you start noticing birds is how to identify one in flight. You have to sort through a series of visual clues all at once, at high speed. Silhouette, wing shape, how fast it flaps, dark and light patterning. An experienced birder will take in all these and other clues. So, if you hang around long enough, you might hear something like, "Look, a hawk. Must be a Cooper's hawk. It has that jizz." In other words, it has all the telltale signs. But where did this bit of birdwatching slang originate? One explanation takes us back to World War II, when trained spotters scanned the skies and identified airplanes by a coded system called General Impression of Size and Shape, or GISS. Each plane, enemy or friend, had a GISS. Birders simply borrowed the concept, spelling the word by its sound, jizz. Makes perfect sense. Except some birders apparently used the word as early as 1920, which has led to speculation that it's derived from the word gist. Whatever the origin, getting a general impression of the size and shape is a good start for identifying a bird in flight. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Aware is proud to announce the 2016 Women of Distinction. Congratulations to Marie Darlin, Justine Munch, Missouri Smith, and Christy West. We'll celebrate the honorees at the 20th annual Women of Distinction Gala and Silent Auction on March 5th at Centennial Hall. For tickets, call Aware at 586-6623 or go online at thejackoraware.org.
Support for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
And I'd like to welcome into the studio Mark Wilcox. And Mark is the event organizer of something that sounds really cool for this part of the world. It's the Backcountry Film Festival. This is going to be Thursday, tomorrow, at the Rockwell. Doors are opening at 7. The film begins at 7:30. And Mark, welcome to KTOO. Welcome to Juneau. I understand you're relatively new to the community. Is that correct?
I am. Thank you.
And here you are. You're already rolling up your sleeves and producing culture for the community. In this case, it's a backcountry film festival. So thank you for doing that. But tell us about the film festival.
Sure. Well, It's a film fest that's produced by the Winter Wildlands Alliance, which is a group that promotes backcountry recreation, non-motorized backcountry recreation and safety. And they make these films available and kind of usually in a grassroots format. So I got to Juneau and nobody was putting these films on this year. So I got out there and got on the community and seemed like it was something worthwhile doing.
So has it been here in the past?
I think it was here the year before last.
Yeah.
So,
there was no second. Nobody was lined up to produce it a second time.
Yeah. No, which is surprising because I've kind of
it's a backcountry crazy place.
Yeah. There's a lot of people interested in coming. So.
So are we talking? Is this strictly winter backcountry activity?
Yes. Yeah. Through the Winter Wildlands Alliance, they focus on the winter aspects. So. There's going to be films about, obviously, backcountry skiing, split boarding. There's one film that involves Conrad Anker, as noted, mountaineer and ice climber. So there's an ice climbing segment. There's a group of women that are sort of are crew sailing a sailboat from Iceland to Greenland and then skiing these backcountry fjords and literally just taking their dinghy over and ski in the slopes on the southwest corner of Greenland. So
for people who tomorrow night go, how many films are in the film festival?
There are about 10 films. Mm-hmm. It's two sort of slugs of 45 minutes. We'll have an intermission in the middle, and they range from anywhere from 4 minutes to 30 minutes in length.
Uh-huh. And who's out there producing these things? I mean, I realize they're backcountry enthusiasts, but I'm assuming these films are pretty good. They have to hit a certain quality mark to get into the film festival. So any sense for who's out there doing this?
Yeah, I mean, some of them have a high production value. So yeah. You have sponsors, a lot of the big retailers like Black Diamond or Outdoor Research and some of those are sponsoring them, Patagonia, co-sponsors. Some of these films, a few of them are included in other film festivals like Telluride, like Japan by Van, which is by Sweetgrass Productions, which is a known maker of these kind of films. Some of them are smaller production that have been picked up and kind of carried on by some of these other producers. So there's one called The Forecaster, and it's about an avalanche forecaster and kind of what he does on a daily basis and kind of not just the mechanics, but like, basically, the philosophy of like keeping yourself safe while you're out there, and then there's other ones that are pretty low production but they're high quality. One was by Rayon Brother Films and it's called I Love Splitboarding. So, and it's just a fun down to earth kind of experience.
So it's all winter season backcountry adventure based and recreation based. I looked online at a few and it looked great. I mean, if what I saw online is any hint or indication of the kinds of places you're going to get to see and adventures you're going to get to at least visually, you know, witness, looked pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, we're everything from, like I said, Greenland to Pico de Orizaba, which is Mexico, showing basically a couple younger guys being weekend warrior and going down to do a ski mountaineering expedition on this thing.
In Mexico. A skiing,
Yeah, it's a big volcano, the third highest peak
in North America.
There
is a really big mountain there.
Yep.
And they get snow.
Yeah, and they thought it was a great idea to try to squeeze us in on a weekend. most of the guys are kind of semi-professional.
Right.
The one guy is a desk jockey, and he... It's pretty funny watching him suffer.
And so in the Japan by Van, that name piqued my interest, actually, because I know people in Juneau who are now the last sort of getting into this. We go to Japan to ski, and, you know, it's caught on a little bit here. So Japan by Van, Sweetgrass Productions, that's in the film festival.
Yeah, and takes place in the Shirakawa backcountry. I honestly have just had my eyes open. There's more and more talk about Japan, but a lot of people think of Japan totally differently. But the North Island of Japan has just some immense snowfall and fluffy, consistent snow. So this definitely celebrates that and gives us a little exposure.
And this is a fundraiser, right? There's a local organization I realize you're the organizer, but you're working with the Avalanche Center, is that correct? Or they're the beneficiaries of the revenue?
Yeah, they're the beneficiary. So I originally thought when I put this together that it would go back to the Winter Wildlands Alliance, but they actually, their goal is to get more money out to other grassroots organizations. So thought it was fitting. There's some things about avalanche safety, and seemed to be a good fit. I just took a avalanche safety course myself, so seemed like a good way to give back.
And is it $10 at the door? Is that what I read or heard, or is it suggested donation, or, you know?
Yeah,
pay as you can, or how are you framing this?
It's a $10 suggested donation.
But
certainly,
it's worth $10. You're going to get 90 minutes of outrageous backcountry footage. You know,
it's always been a good time. I used to take part in this back home for years and years, and I didn't see myself missing it again. So hopefully, we're going to put something on that everyone's going to have a good time at. $10 will be a low lift, and we're going to be doing raffle prizes as well to raise some more money. So it's going to be $1 a raffle ticket, and we've got a lot of local sponsors, some of the local retailers like Foggy Mountain, Nugget Nugget Alaskan Outfitters, Rookery, Cycle Alaska. I can name a few more names, but they've all given little token prizes, and there's a national raffle as well to win a big ski package. So I think it's going to be a good time.
And it struck me that these kinds of films, you don't have to be a backcountry winter recreation enthusiast to enjoy these. I mean, obviously those folks will love it, but I think for anybody who appreciates the outdoors and the beauty of Alaska or wild places in the wintertime and recreation are just going to enjoy watching this because they're highly entertaining.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is much about the people as well as the stories. And you know, they're not your usual sort of ski film. A lot of them have a method behind them. Some of them, there's one in Vermont, talks about some of the grassroots effort to make access more available and sort of the lifestyle of people trying to enjoy the backcountry as well as developed areas. So, yeah, I think there's still something for everyone. And, you know, this also speaks to just snowshoers and folks like that. But all these films have an aesthetic of just being out in the backcountry and kind of puts you there, especially in winters like this where you know, it's a mixed bag.
Jonesing for the backcountry maybe more so than some winters. So, and just for you personally, are you a backcountry person in the wintertime? Are you out there enjoying yourself?
Yeah. Despite living in the Washington metro area for a number of years, I definitely got out in the backcountry as much as possible. And, I get out and ski and board and whatever I can, dabble in some ice climbing. So I'm all smiles for tomorrow.
Anything else about tomorrow's Backcountry Film Festival that you would like to talk about before we wrap this things up here?
I guess just let's hope we can all make it out. There are some avalanche safety courses coming up, and we'll talk about those tomorrow. But, you know, just I guess the safety message is important. Get out there, have fun, but do it safely. Mm-hmm. So that's about it.
Very good. We've been speaking with Mark Wilcox. He's fortunately, he showed up and said this film festival needs to happen in Juneau, so he's organized it. It's the Backcountry Film Festival. It's going to be tomorrow night. Doors open at 7 at the Rockwell. Film begins at 7:30. It sounds like there's other fun things, so go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to also just thank everyone that's bared with me. I've been running around town and just like stopping people on the streets. Have you heard about this? And so I hope it's a success and I hope everyone has fun, but I appreciate everyone being patient and Juneau's been amazing, like group of people and really friendly and kind of welcoming. So
yeah,
can't say that about Washington, D.C.
Well, this place cranks out an amazing amount of events and opportunities, and a lot of it is exactly what you're doing, which is just making it happen. So congratulations on that front, and I suspect you're going to have a nice turnout tomorrow, so good for you. Mark Wilcox, nice meeting you, and thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And the music in the background is the Young Dubliners, and they will be playing at Suite 907 on Thursday, February 19th. Weather forecast. Well, I'm looking. I'm trying not to find rain in the forecast, but that's not the case. There's just variations of rain over the next several days, so we'll call that the forecast. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau, and thank you to Jeff Brown for producing the show this afternoon.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown.